one text I've seen recently has this rather interesting paragraph that starts out. It's impossible for any sensitive person to look at a star-filled sky without being stirred by thoughts of creation and eternity. The mystery of the origin and destiny of the universe haunts us throughout our lives. It's interesting that recent years, the development of scientific technology of various sorts, a development of large radio telescopes that can look out into space, a development of rockets that can carry humans to the moon and back, development of landers that have landed on Mars, a development of probes going out beyond Jupiter, we now know a good deal more about the solar system than we did only 20 years ago. And that has helped scientists to try and think through the whole question of how did the solar system come to be? How did the planet Earth get out there the way it is and around a sun like we've got? And we want to look this evening at some theories that have been proposed and some scientific evidence that needs to be looked at in regard to this whole question of the origin of the Earth and of the solar system. But one of the striking things we want to point out to you is that the Bible, written over 3,500 years ago, has a picture of the origin of the Earth and of the sun, etc., that fits very well with what we have come to understand as the scientific model that seems to best fit the data of the solar system. This is a little surprising because many, many Christians read Genesis 1 as telling us that God said, let there be earth, and boom, there was an earth, and let there be plants on it, and twink, they all sprang up, and things of that sort, and think that that happened a few thousand years ago, and that does not fit what the scientific evidence looks like in the area. But when you look at what the scientific evidence looks like, and then you go back and look at the biblical material, it is in fact consistent. And that's what we want to try and show you this evening. And there's a good reason why it's consistent, and that is because the Bible was made by the same being that made the universe. And he knows how he made it. And he's able to explain how he made it. And he's able to explain it in simple, non-technical language, which is, after all, what we'd expect if he wants it to be read over many thousands of years. So that basically is what we're looking at, a fit between the biblical material and the scientific material regarding the origin, not the whole universe, that's a separate talk, but of the origin of our sun and the planets around it, and particularly of our planet Earth. We want to start out, first of all, then, and look at the scientific data that scientists look at in trying to say, what kind of a model, what kind of a theory can we propose for the origin of the Earth? And we're going to look at two or three varieties after we looked at scientific data, and then zero in on the one that's generally accepted. So what scientific data needs to be fit to explain the nature of the origin of the Earth and the solar system? Well, one thing we have to see is that when you put all the members of the solar system together, the sun is obviously far the dominant partner. Here's a picture that shows us the diameter of the sun against the diameter of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, etc. Roughly compared to Jupiter, the sun is like a basketball to a large marble or a very small ping pong ball. And the Earth, compared to Jupiter, is like, again, a small ping pong ball or a large marble compared to Jupiter as a basketball. You can see something of the size difference there. The cross-section of the Earth is about 8,000 miles diameter, and the sun's diameter is not quite 100 times that, about 600,000 miles across. So big, big differences. Almost all of the mass of our solar system is in the sun. Something like 750 parts of the mass are in the sun, and just one part scattered to all of the planets, their little moons that go around them, and all of the comets and stuff we know about, asteroids as well. On the other hand, the angular momentum of the solar system is dispersed out in the planets, and not much of it is in the sun. What's angular momentum? Now, most of us have heard the term momentum. You think about a fullback plowing into the line or something of that sort, and he's got a lot of momentum because he's running fairly fast and he's heavy. And if he's running the same speed and not as heavy, he hasn't got as much momentum. Or if he's running a little faster and has got the same weight, he's got a little more momentum. It depends upon the weight, the mass, and the velocity. Angular momentum is the ability of something rotating to keep rotating. Momentum is sort of the ability of something moving to keep moving. Rotational momentum, angular momentum, has to do with rotation speed. Here we have an example of a guy in a physics lab, you know, a physics demonstration lab of some sort, sitting on a little stool on a rotating platform, and he's got two little dumbbells in his hand. And put the guy on the left-hand side like that, and you have him stretch his arms out with the dumbbells in it, and you begin rotating until you get him rotating, say, once every couple seconds, which is fairly fast. And then if he pulls his arms in, he'll rotate faster suddenly, even though you're not pushing him anymore. This is probably much more familiar to most people if they've seen ice capades or something of that sort, because a skater will often do this. The skater, he or she, will start to spin, and then she'll pull her arms in, and she'll spin faster, and then put them out, and she'll spin slower. Reason for that is that in rotation, on rotational momentum or angular momentum, the speed of rotation and the distributed mass are actually what is at work. And if you move mass out further like this, then it doesn't have to spin as fast to have the same momentum. If you move it in closer, it's got to spin faster to have the same. Why all that discussion? Well, we'll see later on in the course, discussion tonight. Whereas most of the mass of our solar system is in the sun, most of the angular momentum is out in the planets and to a lesser extent in their satellites, the moons. Here's a little chart that shows that. Angular momentum measured in some units, which you don't need to worry about over on the left. But the Jupiter's got almost 200 of these units. Saturn's got nearly 100. Neptune has got, looks like, 30 or so. Uranus is more like 30. Neptune's 40. What's the sun got back over there? Only about 10, 8, something of that sort. See, most of the angular momentum. Now, that is unusual for most astronomical objects we know about. For instance, the galaxy with all its stars in it has got some concentration of mass towards the center, but not nearly as much as our solar system, and it's got some angular momentum spread out, but not nearly as much, and other objects of that sort, you would see the same sort of thing. It appears that something has happened in the formation or early history or something of the solar system to put almost all the mass in the center and to put the angular momentum out near the outside. Well, it's kind of technical. I hope most of the rest of the talk won't be quite as technical as that. Imagine we're out in a spaceship looking down on the solar system from the north, and we are looking at the planets as they go around the sun, and we are looking at imaginary lines that mark out where they would go, their orbits. And you get a picture that looks something like this. The orbits of nearly all of the planets are very, very round. The only obvious exception to that in this picture is the orbit of Pluto, which goes out further than any of the other planets here on one side, but then actually comes in a little closer than the planet Neptune over here. And in fact, at the moment, Pluto is still is not the furthest out planet right now. It happens to be in the part of its orbit that's inside of that of Neptune. I don't think that'll last much longer. Even that orbit, if you looked at it by itself, would look fairly round. It's just that when it's set by the others, it doesn't look very round. The orbits, in fact, of the planets are ellipses rather than circles, and the sun, which is in there where that line is pointing, is at one of the foci of the ellipses, which is corresponds as you make the ellipse more and more circular to what would be the center of the circle. The interesting thing is, then, the orbits of the planets are nearly circular, and the planets are all going the same way around those orbits. They're all going this way. Back when we used watches with dials on them, well, we still got one here, we call counterclockwise, okay? The opposite the direction clock hands go when you're looking down from the north. So, orbits of the planets are nearly circular, and the planets are going the same way around the sun, and if you looked in close at the sun, you'd find that's the way the sun is rotating on its own axis as well. Counterclockwise is viewed from the north. Now imagine we swing down from above the solar system and come down here and look at it on edge. What happens then? Well, here's kind of what the solar system looks like on edge. We're looking at all these orbits again. And except for Pluto, which is kind of cockeyed, all the rest of them lie very, very nearly in one plane, within about 7 degrees, I believe, of the plane. Mercury's the least aligned of the remainder. After you take out Pluto, that's all something 14 degrees or something like that. So here's what we got. We've got to explain how you form a system of a star and a bunch of planets in such a way that the star is rotating the same way that the planets are, that the planets are going in nearly circular orbits, that they lie very nearly in one plane, that nearly all the mass is in the center of the solar system, nearly all the angular momentum actually in the fraction of 200 to 1 is out in the planets rather than in the sun. And then there's a little chemistry that it's helpful to try and explain as well. Here's another picture of the relative size of the planets and the sun with just the kind of an edge of the sun shown here on that line. But it shows us that the planets fall into two groups, largish planets and smallish planets. I say that's no big deal. You know, any distribution you have, you could sort them into those two. But those two distributions also show something else. The chemistry of the four big planets is rather different than the chemistry of the little planets. We're not so sure about Pluto, though it is over there in a little planet. But we know about the inner planets. They are all heavy, and they're made of stuff that you have to heat up to very, very high temperatures to get them turned to liquid. That is, you have to heat the stuff up to 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 degrees to get it to turn liquid. The big planets are very light for their size, and they're made of material that most of them at room temperature would already be gas. They, in fact, are only solidish. And actually, none of those planets are solid on what looks like the surface. That's the upper part of their atmosphere, which is quite thick. But they would be liquid or solid really only at very, very low temperatures, well below zero. So two different kinds of chemistries in the planets. And what's interesting about them is the outer planets, the four big outer planets, are dominated by hydrogen and methane and ammonia and such. And those elements are also rather dominant elements in the sun. So we've got some kind of a strange arrangement in which the chemistry of the sun and the chemistry of the outer planets is very similar, and the chemistry of the intermediate planets is very dissimilar. Well, I think that's the last feature we need to think about here in regard to the scientific data. Now the question is, how do you explain this data? How do you explain a solar system like that? And it would not be a wrong answer for Christians to say, God made it that way. He did indeed. The question would be, did God use any process? Did God just say, let there be planets, and poink, there are planets? Have to look, have to see what kind of data we can find there. But scientists typically ignore God. Not that lots of scientists don't think about God, but that it's hard to get articles published in journals when you mention God. And the guys who have constructed the various models for explaining the origin of the solar system, I think, did not really look in the Bible at all and did not really think about God at all when they made these models. But the amazing thing about it is that the best model they've come up with, that is the one that they would generally agree best fits the data, has a rather striking fit with the biblical material and that we want to investigate. Well, various models that have been proposed for the origin of the solar system. One of them is the idea that, well, I don't know where planets came from in general, but the way our planets came to be around our sun is that our planets were just kind of cruising through space, and they got captured by the sun. A capture theory is what this would be called, perhaps a random capture theory. A Russian medical doctor who wrote several rather provocative works in the 50s, Emanuel Velikovsky, made that kind of claim. He claimed that the Earth and other planets were just captured by our sun as the sun traveled through space. He might have been picking up an idea from a science fiction novel in the 1930s called When Worlds Collide, which is made into a film. I don't know whether any of you happen to go back far enough to have seen the film. It was probably came out in the 50s or 60s. But the idea there was, well, we got all our dying planets, but two planets come wandering in from outside somewhere, and one of them eventually smashes into the Earth, and the other one kind of sails by, and the question is, can mankind build rocket ships fast enough to allow some people to escape from Earth and land on the one planet which survives, etc. And interesting story. Well, Velikovsky seems to view something like that. Velikovsky's no Christian as far as I know, but his model has been Christianized by several people. Donald Patton's The Biblical Flood and the Ice Epic over here on the left, and then work he collaborated with several other people on The Long Day of Joshua and Six Other Catastrophes, sketches the same sort of thing, a claim that you can explain the origin of the solar system and such by capture of planets. The trouble with that is that you don't get the kind of orbits we've got here with this kind of a capture theory. Instead, you get orbits that kind of look like the way we often imagine orbits around an atom look. We really don't know what orbits around an atom look like, but this is a common sort of design. That is, going all sorts of different directions and at different angles and such. That's what you would normally get with a random capture theory. And the chances that by random capture you would get them as lying nearly in a plane as we've got them is like 1 chance in 10 to the 25th. And the chance that you would get them circular as we've got them also is something like that as well. And when you start getting odd numbers, when you start getting strange unlikelihoods like that, you can generally figure you're missing something in your explanation. There must be something else going on. And the suggestion would be there must be some way in which you will naturally get the planets lying in some kind of nearly flat orbits. When I was growing up, I guess in the late 40s and early 50s, a common claim in most of your scientific literature was that the way we got our planets was that our star passed close by another star, and the two of them interacted so strongly, they got so close to one another, that they ripped gas off of each other's surface. And this gas then went into orbit around them and gradually cooled off and became molten and then cooled off and became solid and became planets. And so here's a diagram of one star coming up this way and the other star coming into that direction and passing quite close together here at somewhere around this point. And the idea would be they pass close enough together that they raise these huge tides of hot gas on the surface of each and pull it out and such. This has the advantage that this will produce planets that would go in orbits that lie in the same plane, and that the stuff pulled out of one particular star and going in orbit around it will probably all be going the same way, which would probably be this way for that one, and yeah, the same way for the one over for the other star. So those would work all right. Your big trouble is it doesn't look like you're going to form planets this way, because once you pull a lot of hot gas out from the surface of a star, it hasn't got the star's gravity to hold it together. It just disperses. It doesn't collapse into planets or anything of that sort. The temperature is way too high. We know the temperature of stars is a few thousand degrees at its surface, and strangely enough, the temperature of gas at a star gets higher and higher as you go away from the star for a ways, or at least it does for our star, and you would not get any kind of planets this way. So this theory was finally junked after a while when some calculations were made and we understood stars a little bit better than before. The theory that is dominant now and has been so since perhaps the 60s is a development, and they use the word evolution here. Anti-Christians like to use the word evolution. It's just a nice Latin word for development, you'll see. But somehow if you can use evolution when you talk about the solar system, and if you can use evolution when you talk about the history of the universe, and evolution when you talk about biology, it sounds like you've got it all together, even though they're totally different theories, and the evidence for them is totally different. The evidence for the origin of the solar system is really pretty good, as we'll see. The evidence for evolution of biological evolution was, in fact, rather problematical, as we suggested 2 weeks ago. But here, this much, I think, is fair to say, despite varying theories, present consensus favors a model in which planets formed at about the same time as the Sun out of a huge cloud of gas and dust. And then details are speculative, okay? Let's have a look at what we've got there. The idea here is that before our sun formed, it was a large cloud of gas and dust, very, very thin, very dispersed over a very large volume. And we can show you some pictures, as we will by and by, of gas clouds of that sort that you can see out there in space even now, and some pretty good evidence that stars that appear to be younger are close enough to those things that they probably formed in some such places. Now, a gas cloud sitting out there might be dispersing. It might just be kind of sitting there. It might be collapsing. That will depend on the combination of how much gas is in the cloud and how hot the cloud is. If the cloud is cool enough, it will condense under its own gravity. If it gets above a certain temperature, it will not condense. It will, in fact, expand and disperse. It basically deals with the question of a fight between expansion under the under gas pressure and condensation under its own gravity. There are several forces operating. We're going to imagine a gas cloud contacting, okay, because if our star formed, if our sun formed this way, it formed by one that was contracting, not by one that was expanding. So we imagine what we've got there. We've got the self-gravitation of all of gas pulling the thing together. We've got gas pressure pushing it out in all directions. And typically, for a gas cloud of this sort, it will have some kind of a rotation due to even random motions in it, apart from something else. As this thing begins to pull together, that will be magnified, just as the skater pulls her arms in, her spin goes up faster. So that rotation will gradually be magnified. Now, If you did not have that rotation, the gas cloud would collapse and become more and more sort of spherical. But with that rotation, the stuff that's trying to collapse in from the side, we're making the axis of rotation up this way and the whole thing rotating like this, the stuff that's trying to collapse in this way has got centrifugal force pushing it out, as well as as well as gas pressure. What's centrifugal force? Well, here's an experiment you can try. Don't try this while your mother's in the kitchen, but when she's out. Take a container of cake batter and put it in a mixer with the water and an egg, if you like, or whatever needed, and get the mixer there and put it down in it and turn it on, get it going good. And then when it's going good, you tilt it back like that. And you immediately have an experience of centrifugal force. You've got some batter right up the face there, across the wall and down the other side. And if you notice where it comes out, you see that it's going at right angles to the axis of rotation. Here's the beater, so the axis of rotation is this, and it went shoop right there, and it falls to this thing and down. So that's what's going on here. So a gas cloud contracting has got gravity pulling it in all directions, gas pressure pushing out in all directions, and on our assumption at this moment, the gravity is stronger, so it's coming in. It's got this rotational centrifugal force, and that's hindering it from collapsing along its, we'll call it its equator, as rapidly as it collapses along the pole. And if left alone, you will get some kind of a pancake result in this particular thing that goes this way. And that's, in fact, part of the reason why those guys who operate in real Italian pizza parlors flip their dough up in the air and that sort of thing. That uses centrifugal force to flatten the stuff out, that sort of thing. So here we imagine our gas cloud collapsing. We presume at this point it's picked up a little bit of a shape. Collapse is resisted a little more from coming in from the equator than from the poles, and at first you begin to get what we call an oblate spheroid. Okay? A sphere, spherical shape, same distance in all directions from the center. A oblate spheroid is shaped like an M&M chocolate candy non-peanut type. Okay? Whereas a prolate spheroid is shaped like an M&M chocolate candy peanut type. Okay? So that simple explanation there. If the gas cloud is spinning too fast, it will typically break into two pieces that will eventually form two stars. And this is the artist's conception up here of two stars that are formed and are rotating around each other. And in fact, most of the stars we're familiar with, that is, that are close enough for us to look at, most of them are double or triple stars. Single stars are rarish. Maybe, I don't know, 20%, something like that, rarish. Now, as far as we can tell, though, when you form double stars like that, you probably don't form planets. So this artist here who's looking at the two stars from the surface of a planet rotating around is probably cheating a little bit, other than the imagination, since nobody's been on such a planet, just that we think we won't get planets under those circumstances. Maybe under special things. If the two stars are far apart, maybe you could get a couple of planetary orbits in close to each star, but we doubt it. Or maybe if the stars are very close together, you could get some planetary orbits out far, like we've got here, but again, we doubt it, because both of those are going to be disruptive on actually forming the planet, and they're going to be disruptive on the planet maintaining a stable orbit for many, many millions of years. And both of those are problematical. Now, the model I'm going to be looking at is discussed in Chapter 6, I believe it is, of Fred Hoyle's Frontiers of Astronomy, done way back in the early 50s. Hoyle was no Bible believer back then. I don't think he's a Bible believer even now, although the difference is he was an atheist of some sort when he wrote this stuff, and he has come to believe that there might be a God out there after working on the whole question of the origin of life. But he certainly didn't think so when he did this. He was not attempting to harmonize with Scripture in any way. What he suggests is that as the gas cloud begins to collapse and it gets a little bit more oblate, if you like, that eventually it gets hot enough. I got ahead of myself a little bit. Eventually, it collapses enough that the gas becomes opaque. That is, the gas-dust combination is thick enough you can't see out of it. Just like you can see clouds in the sky, and some of them are rather thin, you can see through them. See the moon or through them. Sometimes you can see stars through them. A little thicker, you can't see stars through them. A little thicker, you can't see the moon through it, and such. As this gas cloud collapses, it would get thicker and thicker and thicker, and it would get dark inside. But then eventually it gets hot enough, because as it collapses, it gets hotter and hotter. There's some ins and outs of the physics of that. But as a cloud collapses, although it's throwing off some heat, it gets hotter and hotter. And eventually it gets hot enough inside that it ionizes. It strips the electrons off of the atoms in there, and it begins to glow. And if you were inside the gas cloud at that point, first, inside the gas cloud, you could see out. Then, as the cloud gets thicker, it gets dark. You can't see out. It's too thick. Then it begins to glow everywhere. And it's light all around you. When it begins to glow around and all around you, you get another force at it. Already we had gravity pulling in, gas pressure pushing out, centrifugal force pushing out in more of a cylindrical way or at the equator. Now we begin to get magnetic forces at work. Once the thing begins to glow, you get what we call plasma, and the plasma begins to produce magnetic fields. And that shifts us over from the sort of M&M chocolate candy type, non-peanut type variety, over to what we might call what looks like a fried egg on a mirror. You're still retaining this sort of flattened thing for the center, but now you're putting out a little disc around it. That disc has come from inside the other, and what's happened is the magnetic fields now are transferring angular momentum to the equator and get enough transferred that this actually now begins to move out instead of collapsing inward. It slows down this inner part a little bit, and it speeds up the outer part, so the inner part becomes a little more round, and the outer part pushes out and becomes a equatorial band, if you like. Looking down from the top, here's kind of what it looks like. This is the thing that's going to eventually form the sun here. There's all these magnetic field lines kind of wandering around in it, and as the thing rotates, it winds them up like rubber bands. And as it winds them up, it pulls this stuff faster, and actually the arrows go the other way. It pulls this stuff faster, and that makes it speed up, and that makes it slow up. Newton's third law, every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Eventually, as that stuff pushes out, it gets far enough away from the hot center part that it cools off, and it begins then to condense into little dust particles with gas in them, and when the dust particles condense out, they aren't hooked to the magnetic field anymore. One illustration I might give you on this. If you want to imagine this, you can imagine that you have a bowl of spaghetti there. The Italian type, long strands, not broken up in pieces like the non-Italians do. And imagine that the spaghetti represents the magnetic field lines of force, and that the sauce represents the gas. And imagine that the rotation here is being produced by your sticking a fork in the middle and twisting it like that. Well, what you'll find is you will begin to twist up the spaghetti, and if you have it sitting in a bowl on the table, you'll actually begin to turn the bowl, perhaps even depending somewhat on how slick the bowl is relative to the spaghetti. So you get a little idea of the transfer of angular momentum and the winding up of these magnetic field lines and all of that in that particular sort of thing. I think we can get a little better focus on that. There we are. So that basically is the sort of shape you begin to get. A condensation in the middle that's going to form the sun, and this disk that's being pushed out here, and as that moves away from the hotter part here, it begins to cool off. And the heavy, what we call non-volatile material condenses out here, and the lighter volatile material goes out a lot further before it condenses out. And so you're going to begin to get a disk that is chemically distinct as you work your way out. The heavier, higher melting point stuff in close, and the lighter, lower melting point stuff further and further and further out. That stuff then will begin to condense down. This is a picture of a galaxy, not of a early form of a solar system, but shows you the kind of thing you were looking at. A condensation towards the center, an equatorial band, a dark gas material in it. There's some of the same processes that go on and on the galactic scale as go on in a solar system, but some differences because of the size differences. The stuff here begins to form up as dust particles first, as it gets further away from the thing that's going to form the sun. And then those dust particles begin to bang into one another and get to be bigger particles until they're sand size, and then they're gravel size, and then they're golf ball size, and then they're finally begin to get planet size eventually. Lots of collisions and such things going on as they run into one another. But they're all going the same way around the sun, which is also going that same way around. And if you turn it up on edge, they all lie very nearly in one plane. The only thing that will disrupt that is as you get bigger and bigger particles running into each other, When you begin to get semi-planetary-sized particles running into one another, they may disrupt the shape of the orbit a fair bit, or they may certainly disrupt the tilt of the planet in its own orbit, because a substantial collision of one object with another could do something of that sort. It appears in this model that in agreement with what we have from the mineralogy of meteorites and such, that instead of the planets starting out as gas, cooling down to become liquid planets, molten planets, and then cooling down to become hard planets, that in fact the cooling from gas to dust, etc., took place at very small particle sizes, and then the stuff collided together and formed bigger and bigger objects. So that the inference is that at least the terrestrial planets, the inner planets, Earth, Venus, Mercury, Mars, etc., they were formed cold, that they were not wholly molten at any point, that the melting of them actually takes place later after they're formed rather than before. And that they were formed by the accumulation of these infinitesimal planets, what they call planetesimals, in the presence of certain gases. So they get these little particles had gases attached to them of one sort or another. Well, a little review of what all of this would look like. That's what the outer planets are picking up most of the junk in their orbits. One thing that's been noticed is we have two pretty good-sized planets in our solar system, Jupiter and Saturn, but they're not quite big enough to be stars. Jupiter would have to be maybe 10 times bigger than it is for the temperature to get high enough inside to turn on the reactions that make stars. But it does look like they got big enough to form little planetary systems of one sort or another. So you've got a ring around Saturn that looks a little bit like what they might think an early planetary ring would look like around a star. And in fact, you've got a ring around Jupiter, we now know, though it's much less impressive looking, and a ring around Uranus, though it's much less impressive looking. You've also got a little system of moons or satellites around Saturn and Jupiter, and I can't even remember the number of them now. I know what they were back when I was learning them in elementary school, but they found all these since then, so my numbers aren't any good anymore. There are 50-some, I think, known for the whole solar system, but I don't remember the distribution anymore. Well, the question of the gas in Earth's atmosphere has been of some interest, and a suggestion here from a fellow named Ruby is that most gases now in Earth's atmosphere are not original, that is, they did not, they weren't the gas that was in this gas cloud, and they aren't something that the surface rocks when they weather produces gas, but they came from inside the planet. As the planet heated up inside and became molten, it produced volcanic effects, and those volcanism pushed out the gases that we have, so that the atmosphere of our Earth is by outgassing from volcanic action going on. So the early history of the Earth and the other planets would perhaps look something like this. You've got volcanoes, as we see over here in the upper right. You've got meteors still smashing in and making craters and things of that sort. And on planets with a fairly active surface, those craters will pretty well all be weathered away or hidden in one way or another. On planets that do not have much surface activity going on, there will be remains of all those craters, as we find on the Moon, for instance, and on Mercury, and to much less extent on Mars and Venus and Earth, though in fact we do find evidence of meteor craters of one sort or another. Well, there are a number of works that could be cited for more detail on this. Berlaga's Origin of the Solar System, William Hartman's Moons and Planets, a text for a college-level course on planetology, would give you a general idea of what's going on. The mineralogy and such, Wood's Meteorites and the Origin of Planets, would give you a little picture of this. Now, what I've talked about so far doesn't sound much like Genesis 1. But we need to go back and take a look at Genesis 1. Before we do, a very quick review of where we've been. You start out with a gas cloud of some sort, and the gas cloud might be very thin to start with, but as it collapses, it gets darker, like this gas cloud here that's blocking the light from behind it. Then it begins eventually to glow, and when it glows, it puts out this this equatorial band of stuff around it, made of the same kind of material, though the less volatile stuff is in close and the more volatile stuff outside. Then that stuff begins to collapse to form planets. The big gas cloud collapses more and more to form a star. Here's what our solar system would look like right now. The sun in the center and the various planets. You can perhaps see a little bit of Saturn there, if I can improve the focus. Somewhere in that vicinity. Yeah. Like that. And this would be what will happen if God leaves things alone long enough to let the sun run out of its fuel, which we do not believe he's going to do. Though there's something in 2 Peter that might sound a little bit like that. We'll have to wait and see how that particular thing works. Well, any evidence that something of that sort is going on, other than the fact that this fits these whole things about all the mass nearly concentrated at the center, the angular momentum at the outside, which is put out by this equatorial band, the nearly circular orbits going the same way around, the separation of the chemistry that we talked about. Well, there are examples of a couple of situations where we've seen a star show up as far as we know there wasn't a star there before. And that may just be a star coming out from behind a gas cloud of some sort that was blocking it. But some of them seem to have a fair amount of gas around them in one way or another and look like we might be looking at an early star. We certainly have evidence out in space of dark little globules. See a couple of them here marked with these arrows that look like they're about the right kind of mass to be the mass of something like our solar system. That is around the mass of a star, but they're a lot bigger than a star right now, and they're dark. They haven't begun to glow yet, and we think those are objects that are collapsing in the direction of becoming a star. And in fact, as you look around a gas cloud area like this, you see a number of stars which, when you look at their spectrum, they look like they are young stars. It's not possible to be certain about that, but that does seem to be what you're seeing. Are there many planets out there? Until just recently, our answer would be, well, we think so, but we don't have any definite evidence, hardly. Until just a few years ago, the main evidence was a nearby star called Barnard Star, which is not a very bright star, but it's pretty close to us. And here, over about a 20-year time period, Barnard Star moves from here over to here. I think that's about that distance on that particular picture. And we have pictures of Barnard Star for over a century now. And when you plot them, it looks like Barnard Star is wobbling a little bit. And you might say, well, why would a star wobble? Well, the best explanation we know of is that a star has either another very dim star around it that you can't see, or it's got planets around it. And the star, you see, doesn't rotate around its own center. It rotates around the center of gravity of the whole planetary system, and that should produce a little bit of a wobble to it. There's been a lot of argument about that kind of evidence because it's very near the boundaries of anything you can detect. But just recently, just in the last 5 years, they have done a much more powerful test, and that is to look at stars and look at the Doppler shift of the star as it's moving towards and away from you. And that kind of a technique of measuring Doppler shifts has been highly perfected. We have experienced it sometimes when we have driven by a state policeman and his equipment out there has detected the Doppler shift of your car and seen that you're doing more than 10 miles over the speed limit and has to chase you down or flag you down or something of that sort. Physicists spending perhaps more money than the state police on individual radar detectors can measure rather small things like the wobble of a star with planets going around it. And they have now detected 5 or 6 planets in the last couple years in that way. It's beginning to look like planets are probably common around single stars. That may be something that's fairly natural. Does not mean that there are necessarily many Earth-like planets out there in the universe. We sketched for you, I think, 2 weeks ago that given a reasonably generous estimate for the number of planets we think there are in the universe, it's unlikely that there's more than one Earth-like planet on all the 30-some things that we were looking at there that have to be within a certain range for life to exist. We'll have to see how that comes out by and by, but that's where it looks at the moment. Currently, we have a Hubble Space Telescope up there, and the intention is to eventually develop some techniques with that telescope to be able to see if we can actually spot planets going around stars. That is a very hard thing to do because the planets are so much dimmer than the stars and are so close to the star that you need very good optics and a very good way of blocking the light and all of that, which we do not yet have. Well, we need to look at the biblical material. And you might say so far, this doesn't sound like the biblical explanation, and this doesn't sound like the biblical account to me. I start out with a gas cloud, collapses, puts out an equatorial band, the stuff condenses, forms the sun, forms the earth, that sort of thing. But you got to go back to the original. Now, I'm not going to try and mystify you with any Hebrew, because, in fact, most of what I'm going to say can be seen very easily in the English. But what we're really concerned about is what does the text say, not how has it normally been understood? It is often hard to understand and hard to translate what a person is saying if you don't understand the subject they're talking about. And there are some very interesting things in the biblical account when you actually take a look at it. So we're going to go through it in little blocks and see what's happening. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. The Bible is very definite that the heaven and the earth are God's creation. It does not pin down exactly for you what the heaven and the earth is, but I suspect that's the way the author describes the whole universe. Earth, where we are, and everything else, heaven. Then he says, the earth was without form and void. There was some time when the earth was shapeless and empty. Well, that's interesting, because our model we looked at started out with a shapeless gas cloud that was a better vacuum than you can make on earth. And that gradually collapses to form the sun and the planets. And darkness was upon the face of the deep. Does that mean everything started out dark and there had been no light in existence before then? Well, that's a possible way of reading it. On the model we're looking at here, trying to see what kind of fit there might be between the scientific model and the biblical account, as this gas cloud begins to collapse, it eventually gets dark everywhere from the perspective of the viewer. We ask ourselves, how is this being written by God, by Moses, whoever he chose to have write it? Does he write it as though you're up in heaven with God and you're kind of watching over his shoulder? Or does he write it as though you're down on earth and you're looking at what it would look like while it's going on? Well, if you go with the idea that you're down on earth, because that's where you're going to be for most of the rest of the accounts in the biblical material, this makes good sense. It becomes dark everywhere around you as this gas cloud collapses. Then it says the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And the Spirit of God is typically used for oversight of providential processes in one way or another, of guiding things in that particular way. And it seems to be God is, in fact, perhaps brooding or hovering over the face of the waters in this particular passage. And then God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light that was good. And then this very strange passage, and God divided the light from the darkness. It sounds like you've got all darkness, then all light, then some kind of a division. We'll come back to that in a moment. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and it was evening and it was morning one day, or a first day would be a fair way of reading the Hebrew there. So there's no definite article at this particular point. Well, here's our gas cloud, shapeless, empty. After some contraction, it becomes dark, like perhaps this kind of gas cloud here, and after some further collapse, it becomes light everywhere. And then, if you're riding along in the gas cloud, you're inside here somewhere, you're on a piece of what's going to be the earth. As this thing collapses, it gets dark everywhere inside. Then as it begins to glow, it gets light everywhere inside. Then, since you're on a piece that's going to become the earth, you get pushed out into this band, and it's light back over here, and it's dark out there. And so now you've got a separation between light and darkness. And then, let's go back and look at the last statement there in the biblical account. After the light and is divided from the darkness, then God calls the light day, and the darkness he calls night. Now, in Hebrew, just as in English, night and darkness are not the same thing. Night is a kind of darkness. And day and light are not the same thing. Day is a kind of light. What kind of light is day? Well, light is the kind of day when you're on the sun side of the planet. And night is the kind of darkness when you're on the away from the sun side of a planet. And that's true in Hebrew and English and other languages as well. It doesn't necessarily follow that that a writer would know that, speaking of the human authors of Scripture, but that's the case. Well, after this band has been put out, the pieces begin to collapse and collide with one another, and they eventually form up planets. And once the planet is formed, the light over on this side is day, and the darkness over on that side is night. And so it would suggest that looking at the Genesis and scientific material together, we now have a solid planet by the time we've got, and he called the light day and the darkness he called night. And it was evening and it was morning, a first day. We now have day-night sequences. Then we come to the second section. God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. Let it divide the waters from the waters. God made the firmament, divide the waters which are under the firmament from the waters which are above the firmament, and it was so. God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day. Where's firmament? Not perhaps the greatest choice of translation in the world. It goes back to the Latin word, firmamentum, which Jerome used to translate the Greek, the Hebrew word that was here. You know, there was actually a Greek word that was being used in Greek translation. The word means something spread out. And it might be something solid that's spread out, like when you take a lump of gold and beat on it with a hammer until you spread it out into a thin gold sheet. But it might be something that's spread out in other ways. A cloud, when it is spread out, could be called a expanse. And you'll see the NASB uses the word expanse here instead of firmament. Something God produces in verse 6 to separate waters. And he tells us a little bit about what it is. It's heaven. Well, what's heaven? Heaven's used three different ways in the Bible. It's used for where God is, some invisible realm where God is. It's used for where the stars are, and it's used for where the birds fly. If we were to label those in our modern terminology, where the birds fly is what we would call the air or the atmosphere. And where the stars are, we would call outer space. And where God is, we would probably still use the word now heaven, okay? Or the unseen realm or something like that. Which of these three is being referred to here? Well, it's got water above it and water under it. What's got water above it and water under it? Well, we don't know much of anything about where God's located, so we don't know what that does or not. Outer space doesn't seem to have any water above it. The atmosphere does. Particularly, if you look at this, the way this word above is used, or prepositions in general, are used with what we call non-solid objects in the Hebrew language. So you'll find something about, for instance, the cloud being under certain water and it is not ripped by the water. And it means the cloud is supporting the water in some way. Or perhaps a better example, a reference to a chaff, or a reference to a tumbleweed being blown in before the wind, in front of the wind. And all it means is that the wind is pushing it from behind. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's no wind in front of it. The wind is pushing it from behind. My suggestion here is, we're looking at something that separates surface water from atmospheric water. And what's that? The atmosphere. And so what we're looking at in this picture is the origin of the atmosphere. God says, the atmosphere was formed after I formed the solid Earth planet. That's exactly what scientists have come to now. The Earth's atmosphere is not the remnant of this nebula and was there as early as even little particles and hung around them and stayed there and formed the atmosphere. No, the Earth was formed, and then inside the Earth, it begins to heat up and it becomes molten, and that begins to produce volcanoes, and they begin to push stuff out, and that's going to become the atmosphere. So the atmosphere is formed after the planet is formed, and it separates the Earth's surface water into surface water and atmospheric water. So here's a picture of a volcano blowing off steam, and it's more than steam, various gases in a water situation where it has in fact just come up through the oceans, as a number of volcanoes do. The Hawaiian Islands are all in fact volcanoes, or extinct volcanoes, that have come up from the ocean floor. There's an account in Job of the creation of the oceans, and it's rather interesting. This is in Job 38, I believe. Let me find, I'm not going to follow my notes here, so find my way back to where we are. Yes, here we are. It is Job 38, verses 8 and 9. God asking Job questions. Who shut up the sea with doors when it broke forth as if it had issued out of the womb? We're looking at the birth of the oceans, pictured in birth language, okay? When I made the cloud the garment thereof, and thick darkness a swaddling band for it. It sounds like the earth has the oceans have a mother. Who's that mother? Earth. And when they come out, there's atmosphere around that's making things dark. There's a cloudy atmosphere that's making things dark. This suggests two things. That if you compare this with the Genesis account, it appears that the formation of the atmosphere and the ocean is simultaneous. And that it appears that the earth is, around that time, covered with a thick cloud cover. Both of those fit very well with the scientific material. The outgassing of the earth by volcanic action produces both the ocean and the atmospheres, and it produces at first a thick cloud cover on the earth, which will need to be removed by some activity of plants further on. But that's the next thing that's described in the Genesis account in verses 9 through 13. And God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place and let the dry land appear. So it appears you've got universal oceans on the earth for a while, and then gradually something happens that opens up ocean basins and dry land appears. And then God called the dry land earth, gathering together the waters he called seas. God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, its fruit tree yielding fruit after its kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth, and it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, herb yielding seed after its fruit, tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after its kind, and God saw it was good, and it was evening, and it was morning, a third day. A picture here, then, of the formation of dry land by the gathering of the oceans, and once you've got dry land, God producing vegetation upon it. Well, we know now, and we did not know this 40 years ago, 50 years ago anyway, the Earth's surface is kind of moving around on top of the rest of the Earth. In the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a mid-Atlantic ridge where new stuff is oozing out and pushing the crust this way, away from either side of the mid-Atlantic ridge, and in fact is pushing the continents apart there. And you've got similar sorts of phenomena at other places on the Earth's ocean and other places where continents or where crusts are colliding with one another and one of them is going down under. And I've got a cross-sectional picture. Yeah, well, this cross-sectional picture is of some interest. Continental crust is a little different than sub-oceanic crust. The continental crust is made of a lighter type of rock that essentially floats on the heavier type of rock. And the result is, once you begin to get some situation where this type of granitic rock is forming, that will stick up and restrict the oceans to their motion. If we had a nice, smooth earth that had no hills or valleys on it, we'd be covered everywhere by about 2 miles of ocean. So you've got to begin to get about a 2 mile relief between the highest and lowest spots on Earth to begin to get dry land showing up anywhere. And it appears that the movement of the surface plates on the Earth either crunched up some of the upper tops of the stuff to make these continents, or the continents were formed by some kind of a weathering from the subcontinental material. But the upshot of it all is that you eventually get a situation where the oceans drain off into areas where there's no granitic rock, and the granitic rock forms the continents. There's a picture showing us a little bit of how we think the stuff moves around. Very slowly, the continents seem to be drifting on the order of about an inch a year, though we can actually measure the drift now with the satellites and devices on the Earth's surface. We can actually see that drift going on, although that's not going to change the arrangement of beachfront real estate and such too quickly, but it is making some changes. Picture taken from the outer space shows you our atmosphere, quite thin for the size of the Earth. Talking on Earth, it's about 8,000 miles through, and perhaps only 8 or 10 miles of atmosphere. And the clouds, the water that is above the atmosphere, supported on, riding on the atmosphere, the Mediterranean here, the waters that are on the surface, and the dry land. This is the Arabian Peninsula, I think we're looking at there. But anyway, that's what we've got. So you can see what we're talking about here. That brings us to the last section we'll be looking at this evening, verse 14 and following. God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night. Let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. Let them be for lights in the firmament of heaven to give light upon the earth. And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to dominate the day, the lesser light to dominate the night. Made the stars also. God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, to divide the light from the darkness. God saw it was good, and it was evening, and it was morning, a fourth day. This is one of the big controversy passages in the Genesis account. Scientists look at this and they say, the writer of this didn't know any science. He has the stars created after the earth. And young Earth creationists say, you scientists don't know anything about what happened. The Bible clearly says God made the stars and the sun after he made the earth. They're both wrong. Both wrong. What the passage is doing is it's saying God cleared the atmosphere so that an observer on the earth could see the sun, moon, and the stars for the first time. Before then, there was day and night, and apparently the temperature range was such that living things could exist, so it was about the same kind of temperature and probably about the same day-night sequence that we got now. Why do you suppose that was? Well, because the sun was out there and the earth was rotating, but there was a thick cloud cover, which we saw back in Job 38. Not so thick that it was dark on the surface in daytime, but thick enough that you couldn't see anything that was out past the clouds. But now the clouds go away, and you can suddenly see the sun, and now the sun can dominate the day, and the moon can dominate the night, and the sun and the moon and the stars in combination can mark off the days and the months and the seasons and the years. The interesting thing about the Genesis account is, this is put right after the creation of plants, and we think that's how the cloud cover on the earth was removed. Plants begin to take the heavy carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and convert it into oxygen and cellulose, plant material. And the animals and such will begin to munch on the cellulose, and other of it will get buried under the ground and that sort of thing. And the result is the atmosphere will become more and more and more oxygenated in this time period. Oxygen is not near as good a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide is. So the temperature will begin to come down, and the clouds will begin to break up, and eventually you will be able to see through. A nice picture from down in the Smokies to show you why they're called the Smokies, and that you can be in a very cloudy environment and you can tell the difference between day and night, okay? So that's all that picture is for. This is a picture of Venus, looked at from above the cloud cover, looked at, I think, in ultraviolet or something of that sort. But Venus is a nice example of a planet that has got a heavy greenhouse effect with thick covering clouds. And so the temperature on Venus is about 900 degrees, whereas if it had an atmosphere kind of like Earth, it'd be down around 200 degrees. An enormous difference that the greenhouse effect makes. What we find here is that it looks like vegetation is the reason why we don't have the greenhouse problem that Venus does. The author here, I believe this is Hartman in New Moons and Planets, says, vegetation and plankton are responsible for the extremely small percentage of carbon dioxide in the present atmosphere, despite all our burning of fossil fuels. Living systems have certainly assisted in the CO2 removal and may have been the decisive factor. If so, then life may be what saved Earth from the heat death of Venus, and is as much responsible for our fleecy skies and blue seas as it is dependent upon them. And then let's hope this will continue, sort of thing. What we've got in the Genesis account, then, is a picture of the creation of vegetation, because vegetation is very important to what God's going to create, animal life, because it provides the food, and it also works the atmosphere around so that the plants, so that the animals can handle the atmosphere. Animals do not work well with CO2 as their breathing source, so that's basically the problem. Artist's conception of the sun breaking through the clouds for the first time. Let's try and put this together and show you correlations between the biblical and the scientific material. Biblical material on the left, scientific material on the right, and a tabulation of it. In the beginning, I'm looking at going to do the left one and the right one for each item. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, Genesis 1:1. A beginning is certainly what the evidence of cosmology points to. We haven't discussed tonight, probably some variety of the Big Bang. The earth then is without form and void, Genesis 1:2. Scientists would say the earth is an amorphous, tenuous nebula. What's amorphous mean? Shapeless. What does tenuous mean? Empty. What does nebulous mean? Gas cloud, okay? Darkness is on the face of the deep, Genesis 1:2. After some contraction, the cloud becomes opaque and therefore dark within. So if we work with a model in which the observer, the person for whom the account is written, where you're to imagine yourself when you read the account, is riding on a piece of what's going to be the earth, you're inside the gas cloud. It's dark everywhere. Spirit of God moves on the face of the waters. A lot of scientists would avoid saying anything about that, but we'd suggest providential oversight and occasional intervention. Don't know how often intervention would be necessary. Let there be light, says God. Further contraction causes the gas cloud to glow. The light is divided from darkness. Planetary material is thrust outside the glowing clouds, and you can see darkness over here and light back here where the protosun is. The light is called day, the darkness is called night. The planet condenses from planetesimals. The presence of the sun and the rotation of the planet give us a day-night sequence. And here the first day intervenes. I'll come back and describe what I think is going on with the days. Genesis 1:6 and following, Job 38, waters burst forth from the womb of the earth. Genesis 1:6, the firmament appears in the midst of the waters. The Earth is heated from within by pressure and radioactivity, driving out the waters and the gases to form the atmosphere and the ocean. Division of the waters above and below the firmament, Genesis 1, 6, and 7, presence the atmosphere allows both surface and atmospheric water. Day 2 intervenes. Come down here. Gathering of the waters, dry land appears, Genesis 1, 9, and 10. Continental material develops from sub-oceanic material by means of volcanism and erosion. Earth brings forth vegetation, Genesis 1, 11, 12, land vegetation appears. Third day intervenes. Lights appear in the sky to mark off the days and the seasons, to dominate the day and dominate the night, Genesis 1, 14, 3, 18. Photosynthesis by vegetation replaces carbon dioxide by oxygen, lowering the temperature and clearing the atmosphere so that astronomical objects are visible. It also prepares the atmosphere for animals and man. You wonder what I was doing with the days there. I believe that the Earth is old. I have tried to make a model, though, in which the days are actually just literal days, but they're separated by long periods of time. And so Genesis first starts to tell us about the formation of the body of the planet Earth, and then it describes day one as intervening, and then tells us about the formation of the atmosphere and the ocean, and then day two intervenes, and it tells us about the formation of dry land and land vegetation, and then day three intervenes, and it tells us about the oxygenation and clearing the atmosphere, then day four intervenes, and it tells us about the air and sea animals being formed. Day 5 intervenes, it tells us about the formation of land animals and man. Day 6 intervenes, and we're in here somewhere, it tells us about God's last creative activity before the new heavens and the earth, the creation of redeemed mankind. And then we'll find it coming to day 7 that will cut these all off. At the current time, there's still some formation of the body of the planet Earth going on. Meteors still crash into the earth. There's still some formation of the atmosphere and the ocean. Volcanoes are still spewing stuff out. There's still formation of dry land because the continental plates are still moving around. Land vegetation, I do not know. I believe God intervenes to make new things. He may have finished doing that long ago. Perhaps that's not still going on. Air and sea animals, over some period of time, God intervenes and intervenes to make those and to make land animals, and then once intervenes to make man, etc. So there's not anything on any large scale going on. There's probably some micro-evolution still going on, mutation and such, adaptation to changing circumstances. That would be the way I see that. That is certainly speculative, but what I'm trying to do is try and see if I can make a scheme that helps me to understand and visualize the biblical data. And what I've been surprised about in working through this, and I didn't start the idea, a friend of mine at Cornell did a lot of the original work on it, and even somebody as far back as Charles Hodge in the last century did some work in this direction, is to show that in fact there's a very strong correlation between what has now come to be the major theory for the origin of the solar system and the Earth and the biblical data. How could that happen? Is it just my guesswork? Why does it fit so well?